Again, this is Ori Ner in Washington with Americans for Peace Now. I want to thank you all for joining us on this conference call. We have Professor Michael Walzer joining us. Professor Walzer is a professor emeritus at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton, New Jersey. He is one of the world's leading experts on ethics in wartime, and he is also a longtime member of Americans for Peace Now's board of directors. Professor Walzer, who published numerous books on and articles in his field of expertise, is perhaps best known for his iconic book, Just and Unjust Wars. Some of you may have also read his latest article in the New Republic, which is an examination of the current Israel-Hamas armed conflict the past 3 weeks or so. Of the ethical dilemmas of this war, of this conflict. In this article, he uses the tools of the just war doctrine in order to examine the ethics of this war. Professor Walzer will start with some introductory comments, and we'll then be happy to take your questions. Before we start, though, a quick comment about questions. I know that we're discussing a very charged topic. Emotions run high, but this is a briefing call in which we are seeking Professor Walzer's wisdom to better understand the ethics and the dilemmas of asymmetric warfare, such as what we've been witnessing between Israel and Hamas in the past few weeks, and then still witnessing now. This is not a venue for vitriol or rants or tirades and diatribes, and so the Q&A will be a Q&A. It will be civilized questions with the objective of seeking answers, and I will use my prerogative as a moderator to keep the discussion as such. To ask a question, you should dial 5-star. You can do that at any time beginning now. That will alert me that you want to ask a question, and I will call on you, of course, time permitting. We're expecting many, many participants. We already have many, I can see. My apologies in advance if I can't accommodate everyone. So again, to ask a question, and I will repeat it later again for those who will join us late, you dial 5-star, and then I will unmute you to let you ask your question. Professor Walzer, thank you for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Okay. Hello, everybody, wherever you are. These aren't good times, and if there are already a lot of you with questions, I will try to be very brief in these remarks. I should just start by saying that the policies that Shalom Achshav has been defending for many years could have prevented this war, and those same policies, if they were implemented, could prevent the next war. So it's just important to say that, I think. But my subject here is supposed to be asymmetric warfare, and that is warfare between a high-tech army, usually a state army, versus some low-tech insurgency, where the insurgents aim at the most vulnerable members of the enemy population, which means at civilians, and they hide behind or fight from among their own civilian population. The human shield is the term that's used a lot. It's not entirely accurate because what this kind of warfare involves is not merely hiding behind civilians, but deliberately exposing civilians to harm. Because high-tech armies lose wars of this sort by killing too many civilians, as we lost, the U.S. lost a war in Vietnam and may be losing a war in Afghanistan. Because this kind of warfare against people who live among and fight from among the civilian population is enormously difficult. Now you can win a war of this sort by killing many, many more civilians, as the Russians did, I suppose, in Chechnya, or the Sri Lankans against Tamil rebels. So that's not an option for Israel. It's also not an option for the Americans in Afghanistan. It's not an option for Israel, both for moral and political reasons. There may be right wingers in Israel who want that kind of victory, but it's not available. And so the crucial question that arises in asymmetric warfare, and that we can talk about when we're in conversation, is what risks do you have to ask your soldiers to take to minimize the risks they are imposing on the civilian population? And that is a highly contested issue in the U.S. Army and in the IDF. I think the official policy of the IDF is that you have to take some risks. You can't put a number. It's not 23 or 47. You have to accept some risks, but you can't. You also have to minimize the cost to your own soldiers, and you have to practice what is called force protection, which is legitimate in warfare. So there's always the balance between the risks you should take and the risks you can't take. In warfare of this sort, and I think I'll just finish by saying that the right policy, it seems to me, is not to try to win wars like this, but to try not to lose them. And the way not to lose is to minimize civilian deaths, to take some risks, and to aim as carefully as you can at military, at legitimate military. So let me just stop there, because I think I would feel much easier responding to questions and comments.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you very much, Professor Walzer. Our first question comes from Stuart Ein.
Hi, I just received an email from Human Rights Watch. They claim that Israeli soldiers, in the course of asking civilians to flee, then turned and shot and killed 7 Palestinians fleeing. What do you do when you get such accusations? How do you weigh them when you do have this situation?
I don't know how you weigh an accusation of that sort. If any soldier in any war did something like that, it would indeed be a war crime. I don't know what I don't know how to judge the source. I do know that the code of conduct and the rules of engagement of the IDF do not permit anything. So any soldier engaged in killing of that sort is breaking rules of his own army as well as international law.
So maybe I'll ask here really quickly. This is Ori Neer in Washington. Again, let me remind people that if they want to ask a question, they should dial 5-star. That will let me know that you want to ask a question, and I will call on you. But I think that one thing that we should perhaps address is the issue of policies versus exceptional behavior that contradicts or that violates military orders. So, you know, there could be, and perhaps this incident that the caller was referring to was the violation of orders, but a question that has, that I have seen discussed a lot in the media in the past few weeks is whether the Israeli military has policies, stated policies, that in any way are, you know, violate international law or are questionable ethically.
I don't think the stated policies, the rules of engagement, violate. Well, look, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a moral philosopher, so I shouldn't say. I'm not going to address the question of violations of international law. I'll just say that what I know about the code of conduct, I know the people who wrote the code of conduct of the IDF, and the rules of engagement, these are morally appropriate. But they do involve decision-making on the battlefield by junior officers. And if any of you have talked to soldiers from Afghanistan or from Vietnam or from Gaza, if you've talked to the children of your friends in Israel, you will know that an awful lot depends on the competence, the intelligence, the moral sensitivity of the lieutenant in the right there, who makes the hardest decisions in wartime. And those decisions vary. A soldier can be frightened. He can be enraged by the killing of some of his comrades. He can lose it. Or he can be calm and confident. And one Israeli friend said to me, the worst killing in war is the result of the incompetence of junior officers. I can't sit in Princeton, New Jersey, and make judgments about that. Mm-hmm. About that sort of thing, but that's you have to look at those decisions on the battlefield, made in very tense circumstances, and we know that some units in the last Gaza invasion, in the last Israeli invasion of Gaza, some units of the Israeli army fought beautifully. According to all the rules, war can't be beautiful, but they fought very well, and others not so. And that's true of the American Army in Afghanistan also.
Thanks. Our next question comes from Tony Lutwinko. I hope I pronounced the name correctly.
You did indeed. Thank you very much, Ori. Professor Walter, I'm most interested. And since you referred to the last Gaza war, and we now have past history about it, I'm most interested in the ethical questions that concern the Israeli army's self-investigation. It seems to me that an ethical sense in that appears to be, shall we say, less than of the highest quality. And that very, very little punishment is being done, nor very little investigation internally of documentation from other groups with evidence that war crimes had been committed. And I'd like to get your take on the ethical dilemma and perhaps some way of maybe countering the ethical lapses that might occur.
Right. No army is very good at investigating its own activities. You remember the American Army investigation of the My Lai massacre. I think what should be urged in the aftermath of wars of this kind is the creation of a commission that might include soldiers retired. Officers, but also maybe even moral philosophers but political and political figures, but independent of the IDF that investigates these practices. we haven't done that in the U.S., and I guess it hasn't been done in Israel, but that's the sort of thing that I think this kind of war requires.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next call comes from Leonard Fine, Label Fine. Please go on, Label.
Michael, even if you credit all of the reports about the placement of rockets in mosques and in or near hospitals and so forth, the level of carnage in the current conflict is so great that if we go back to your opening statement, Israel seems to be losing. How do you reconcile the competing claims on your behavior? How do you deal with the fact that such carnage is unavoidable, and that such carnage condemns you as the aggressor?
Yeah. Hello, Label.
Hi, Michael.
Well, that's the dilemma of asymmetric warfare. That's the dilemma that every high-tech army fighting this kind of a war against this kind of enemy faces. There isn't any easy resolution of you have to explain to the world, which the Israelis have not been doing very well, just what kind of warfare this is. The carnage got much, much greater after the discovery of the tunnels and the decision to send the IDF into Gaza. It increases because when you do that, you shift from using your highest tech weapons from the sky that are actually aimed with at least some precision. You shift to tank cannons and artillery, which are far, far less precise. And you also have Israeli soldiers hunting for tunnels, and you have Hamas militants who know where the tunnels are. So traps can be laid very, very easily. And when an army unit, an IDF unit, gets into trouble, the rules of engagement are relaxed. And they can call in an artillery strike if they're in real trouble that they can't call in before that. And I think, although the IDF doesn't quite say this, I think there have been quite a lot of units in trouble in Gaza.
Yeah.
Since the army moved in, and that's what accounts for a lot of the use of artillery, which is fired from 15-20 kilometers away, and is frighteningly imprecise. I don't know how you limit that. As I said, if the soldiers are well trained, and of course tunnel warfare is totally new, no one has been trained for that really. If the soldiers are well trained and if the commanding officer in the field is calm and collected, there will be fewer calls for artillery strikes.
That little bit showing.
But
push the bags down so they're
very,
open.
Very hard. And as I said before, I'm not willing to sit in Princeton, New Jersey, and judge those difficulties. I do want to say I said this in the New Republic piece. I think the policy of hitting the houses of Hamas officials was morally wrong. whether it's a crime under international law, I don't know, but I've argued this in with regard to other wars, that there are people who are legitimate targets when they're at work, when they're in their office, when they're in the field, who are not legitimate targets when they are at home with their families. You can't say that their children are being used as human shields. And I don't think that was a legitimate target, even when the hitting of the house was quite precise, and they didn't hit a neighboring house. But
there have been cases in which families were harmed.
Yes.
In such attacks. Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Even when warnings given, we had that experience in Vietnam where we also warned people to leave, but people don't leave. You don't just walk away from a house that you've lived in for 30 years and it has all the possessions that you love. You don't just walk away, or at least some people do, but many people won't. And maybe there's a sick relative or an elderly parent or... Yeah, warning isn't enough, and some family house should not be a target.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Don Valachi. Hi, Don.
Hi. My question has to do with the incentives of Hamas to stop unless they achieve some of their objectives, including opening borders, expanding their fishing territories, release of the prisoners, etc. If they don't achieve any of these, their credibility with their own population will be diminished significantly. They're already basically bankrupt. What incentive would they have to stop?
Well, they may run out of, so to speak, of tunnels and rockets, and they do come under some pressure from the civilian population. But it is a hard question what the negotiating tools are for Israel and for Egypt. An Israeli friend said to me in a Skype yesterday, the Egyptians are fiercer than we are. The blockade, the siege, is a joint Israeli-Egyptian project. And... I think both Israel and Egypt don't want the lifting of the siege, which should come. I mean, we all want the siege to be lifted. They don't want the lifting of the siege to be seen as a victory for Hamas. And, of course, that's exactly what Hamas wants. And the effort to bring the Palestine Authority into the negotiations is an effort to solve that problem. I think the Netanyahu government was very, very wrong not to recognize that the unity government was actually a victory for the PA and for Fatah and a defeat for Hamas and should have been welcomed by Israel. And maybe now they realize that it would be, this unity government would be very useful in enabling a lifting of the Gaza siege.
Thank you. The next question comes from Carol Kessner. Carol, you with us?
If the target, yes, if the intended target is at home, in the family home, what if the home is situated over weapon storage or tunnels? Then what?
Right. According to standard just war theory, if rockets are being fired from a civilian home, and if material weapons are being stored in the home, if the home has become a command center, then it is a target, and the presence of civilians in that kind of a home, those civilians could be called human shields who are being used by Hamas. And then the calculation that has to be made by the IDF is whether this is the language of both international law and just war theory. Are the number of civilians likely to be killed disproportionate to the value of the military target? Is it justified to kill 7 civilians in order to hit a storage facility where there are X number of weapons or of rockets?
That is the essence of the principle of proportionality.
Yes, that's the doctrine. And sorry, it's a very imprecise doctrine, and it's been used both ways. That is, it's been used to justify the killing of large numbers of civilians, and it's been used to condemn the killing of even one civilian. Is it worth the death of one child to destroy 15 stored rockets? How do you make a judgment of that sort? And the decision to warn the civilians to leave the house before it's attacked, or and then the willingness to maybe take some risks to make sure that they have left, those are ways of getting around the almost impossible proportionality calculation. Because if you take risks, and just warning people is to take a risk, because especially if you're coming on the ground, because then you're also warning the enemy. You're not only warning the civilians.
You're tipping them off.
Yes. Yeah. So if you do those things, you are it makes the proportionality calculation less important, because you are taking risks to minimize civilian casualties, and that makes it easier to justify the attack if you decide the attack is necessary. Let me give you an example, a very quick example, which an American colonel who'd been in Afghanistan described to me, and I'm sure it's applicable to Gaza also. The American army takes fire from the roof of a small apartment building in an Afghan town. Taliban militants are on the roof. They don't know who's in the building. What do they do? And this colonel said to me, in the old days, we would just pull back and call in an airstrike. And then General McChrystal delivered his new rules of engagement, which said you can't do that. So what can you do? Well, you can try to get onto an adjacent roof to fire at the militants, at the Taliban militants, or you can try to get somebody into the building to see if there are people there, because if there aren't any people there, then you can call in the airstrike. But both of those involve some risks to your soldiers. And this colonel said to me, we have decided in Afghanistan that you have to take those risks. And if the commander, the lieutenant in the field, thinks those risks are too great in this particular case, then you just pull back and hope to get at the enemy on another occasion. And I think that's an example of how you fight an asymmetric war when you're fighting for hearts and minds of the people in the country. Now, Israel is not fighting for the hearts and minds of the people of Gaza, but it is fighting for hearts and minds around the world. And in a way, it's not a different situation. There are political as well as moral reasons for taking the risks, and even for saying, okay, we'll let this target go for now. which I think the Air Force has done on many occasions, because there are civilians. We know there are civilians there, and we hope we'll get another chance later on.
Thank you. Our next question comes from fellow APN board member Peter Weiss. Go ahead, Peter.
Michael, under the Geneva Conventions, an attack on a power plant or other energy-producing installation is strictly forbidden. And yet it has happened in Gaza, and presumably it could not have happened other than as a matter of high-level policy. So how do you evaluate that as a moral philosopher?
I'm on record as condemning the American Army for doing exactly the same thing during the first Iraq war, when we attacked the electricity, power plants, even water purification facilities. If this was a deliberate attack, it was morally wrong and also crazy, because this is Israel supplying electricity to Gaza, and a humanitarian catastrophe that could be caused by failure of electric power. This
would be
a disaster for the people of Gaza, but it would also be a disaster for the state of Israel.
Peter, did you want to ask another question, or?
No, thank you.
No, okay. All right, thanks. So our next question will come from a female voice. I just didn't recognize the name, so I apologize. In area code 212.
Shirley Rauscher.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I just didn't recognize the name.
Okay. It really ties into a couple of other questions here. I think what my concern is here, and I think what we are has been doing, is winning the battle and losing the war and losing the rest of the world. And this is very concerning to me, because I think we're seeing ramifications of that all over the world in other countries too. And here, even in the United States, I'm seeing this. And I know that this has been true in Israel from reporting from there. I think we've lost the bearings. I think Israel has lost its bearings. And we have lost our democracy. We have lost so much of what we've had in the past. Very concerning to me. And the morality here is, and I think the analogy to Vietnam and the analogy to Iraq war, what even we in this country have done, has been atrocious and not setting a good moral tone for what should be going on. If we think always of the other as being other and not human, therefore we can do anything. And I think that is perhaps what I have been seeing and having reported. So that's my question. Where are we, and where are we going, and why?
Thank you.
Yeah, if you think that that Israel has lost its democracy, just wait until this war is over and see what the debate in Israel is like. Because this war will produce a very, very intense political debate and a lot of retrospective accusations and prevarications and efforts at justification. It will be a democratic debate. It may not be pleasant to listen to, but that you can be sure of. I don't think your comment reflects a willingness to engage with the difficulties of asymmetric warfare. the question, anybody who wants to say, well, we've lost our bearings, we're just, there's no morality in this struggle, has got to be willing to say, how do you defend a country against an enemy like Hamas that is doing what Hamas is doing? How do you respond? Finally, just 2 days ago, a Finnish journalist in Gaza told the world that she had seen rockets being fired from the parking lot immediately behind the Al-Shifa hospital. Now, Israel has not sent its missiles into the hospital or even into the parking lot. But how do you respond to that kind of attack? I think in the Israeli response so far, there have been mistakes and wrongdoing, but there has also been a very serious effort to aim at legitimate targets and to protect the civilian population. That's very, very hard to do when you have rockets being fired at you from the midst of the civilian population. I don't think Israel should be, certainly immune from criticism, but we have to make some effort to think about the difficulties it is right now facing.
Thank you. The next question comes from Mark Silverberg, also a fellow APN board member. Go ahead, Mark.
Thank you, Ari. My question is a follow-up on Peter's, or related to Peter's question, in the bombing of the power plant, which inflicts widespread difficulties on the civilian population, on everyone, including the civilian population, to just survive. And in contrast with the UN buildings that were sheltering refugees, that were reported to be a number of them that were bombed after, and the UN officials were livid because they said, I think on 17 different occasions, the exact coordinates of these buildings were provided to the Israeli military, and people who had been driven from their homes were being sheltered in these facilities. Can you enlighten us about that situation at all?
I can't enlighten you about any of the particular incidents. I think it's the UNRWA schools and other buildings that are housing refugees should obviously not only not be targets, but there should be a positive effort to move the fighting away from their vicinity. But that does depend on the cooperation of Hamas. And I suspect that what has happened in some of those incidents is simply that a unit of Israeli soldiers who were doing something that presumably was a legitimate military activity got into trouble, and the commanding officer in the field thought the trouble was desperate and called in the artillery, and the artillery is not very precise. And maybe he shouldn't have done that. I'm fairly sure there are officers in the field who do that and officers in the field who don't do that. But I suspect that is the story in at least some of these cases. What we have to ask of everyone watching this war is we have to demand that they ask the cui bono question, which is always our question: who benefits? You know, when Congress passes some piece of legislation, enhances the position of the wealthiest Americans, we are critical of it. We say who benefits, and we oppose benefits of that kind. It doesn't benefit Israel to hit an UNRWA school. In fact, that hurts Israel. And so you have to assume that they're not trying to do that. You have to assume they're trying not to do that. Simply, I mean, if we leave aside all moral considerations, it is not in Israel's interest to hit targets of that sort, and the soldiers in the field have to have been told to try not to do that. I believe, despite the incident, the awful stories in today's New York Times, that that these are mistakes of very bad mistakes, but they are mistakes. This is not IDF policy.
Thank you. We have many participants and still quite a few questions. So what I'm going to do now is to take two questions together and ask you to answer both. It'll be a West Coast and East Coast one. So we'll start with the East Coast here with Marty Bressler and then Steve Kaplan in L.A. Go ahead, Marty.
Thank you, Laurie. My question concerns when, if at all, someone who is a human shield stops being a civilian and starts to become and becomes a combatant. Take the person who willingly goes to a mosque in order to protect it from being shelled, knowing that there are weapons in there. I think we have to differentiate between your example before of someone in a home and someone in a public facility, for example. Someone who goes to the roof of an apartment building in order to prevent that apartment building from being shelled after it has been made known that it is intended to shell, the IDF is intending to shell that building because it contains weapons. Could you enlighten us on that?
Okay, and then Steve Kaplan?
I have a question about proportionality. Like Marty Bressler, I'm a lawyer, and in the criminal law area, pardon my voice, we can't have a crime without a certain level of clarity as to where the line is between the non-criminal activity and the criminal activity. I think that's a constitutional requirement because people have to know that what they're doing is criminal and could end up in their incarceration. You've said that proportionality is a very imprecise test, and yet it seems to be related to this doctrine of war crimes. And so I'm wondering how you can have a doctrine of war crimes that is based on conduct which requires sort of these very difficult balancing of benefits and whether or not something in a particular instance was proportionate or not proportionate.
Right. Okay. Two good questions. The problem with the willing human shield is that if you see people coming up to the roof of an apartment building that has, when there has been a warning delivered that it is going to be hit, the difficulty for the IDF is that you do not know whether they have come up willingly or whether they've been forced up. Just as you don't know after you've delivered warnings whether the people who haven't left because they've been locked in by Hamas or haven't left because they have aging parents who can't leave. You don't know. And so the general rule, which is a hard rule, is that you treat all civilians as innocent bystanders, even though some of them are not, because that's the only line that can be sustained in war, combatants, non-combatants. If you start arguing that some combatants who maybe are firing their guns in the air and who don't believe in the war are innocent, and some non-combatants who support the war effort are guilty, you lose any hope of fighting with limits, of making the necessary distinction. So you have to figure that the combatants are the human shields are innocent, but sometimes in certain circumstances, this relates to the proportionality of the question. Certain circumstances, you can shoot them, you can kill them.
In
the First World War, I think it was, or in the Franco-Prussian War, the Germans strapped hostages to their tanks and just drove the tanks forward, firing. And the French had to fire back and kill the hostages in order to stop the tanks. And obviously those deaths are not attributable to the French. Though the French did the killing, they are the responsibility of the Germans who put them there. So there will be circumstances where it is justified to kill civilians who are being used by the enemy, and the responsibility for those deaths falls on the enemy. Now, I entirely agree about proportionality. I've written about this at length, but I haven't written about it as a lawyer. In World War II, we bombed German factories that were making, let's say, tanks for the Nazi war effort. And these factories were located in working-class neighborhoods. Nobody had a car, so the factory is right there in the working-class neighborhood. And we knew, given the accuracy of targeting in 1943, we knew that large numbers of civilians were going to be killed, and we said that's not disproportionate. We're stopping the production of tanks for the Nazi war effort, and any civilians we kill, any number, is not disproportionate to the value of doing that. And so that's just an example of how the proportionality rule can give you can set virtually no limits. And then you have something like some UN official on the first day of the last Lebanon war declared that the Israelis were violating the proportionality rule. He didn't even know how many civilians had been killed. So the proportionality is a very, very weak restraint, and a very imprecise one. And that's why I've argued that the question of what care you take to minimize civilian casualties is more important than the question of how many civilians you kill. Morally more important. I don't know how the lawyers would deal with that.
Good, thank you. I'm going to take another batch of two. We have Mr. Slater, whose first name I didn't get, in area code 716, and then Mr. Jabber in area code 602. So, Mr. Slater, you go first, please.
Yeah, so far this discussion has focused solely on the methods Israel is using, with no discussion so far, which I'd like to hear from Michael Walzer, on whether Israel has a just cause in the first place. Because if you don't have a just cause, the issue of proportionality doesn't arise at all. You can't even attack strictly military targets. It becomes an act of aggression. Now, I know the standard answer is, well, of course, Israel has a right to defend itself. But that question begs the more important question of whether its own actions, namely the oppression, the occupation and repression in various forms of the Palestinians, including what is regarded as an indirect occupation of Gaza, is what is leading to these attacks on Israel in the first place. And so therefore, its right of self-defense would be to end the occupation and repression, which I know Michael regards as wrong in any case. And then if it continues to get attacked, then it has a legitimate right of self-defense. So could you please address that issue?
Okay. And then Mr. Jaber, please.
Yes, hi. Mine's kind of on the same path. I'm a dentist in Phoenix, and I always like telling my patients, why would you spend all this money fixing your teeth if the foundation, your gums, are bad? Now, it's probably not the best analogy, but we keep, you know, I've heard a lot about ethics, and I've heard about Hamas using civilians, which it just doesn't seem viable in a situation like that with a population like that. It's kind of a unit. But this code of ethics that I think the military has is irrelevant because I think it relates to the narrative in Israel as it relates to us as human beings. I lived in Palestine. I lived in Jerusalem for a couple of years, and I remember 99% of the time when I ran into Israeli soldiers, it was harassment. It was demeaning. But I ran into one soldier once, and he played soccer with us when we were kids out there. And, you know, to me, it's more about also the nature of the people. And I think this was 20 years ago. I think society in Israel is so detached. It's kind of like I like to call it the bunker mentality. And there will never be peace as long as we keep supporting their unethical behavior because the core is wrong. The core of the whole situation is wrong. Thank you.
So basically what you're saying, if I understand correctly, is that maybe is a way to depict both questions, is that the underpinnings of the situation, the occupation, basically deem any kind of Israeli use of force, military force, unjustified or irrelevant.
Exactly. Hence our conversation. We spent an hour listening to how it's somehow justified because we're not addressing the issue. And I mean, after 60 years, I'm surprised. I love listening to you guys. I love the Israeli left. It gives me hope. But I just, you know, as I said, I remembered one incident, and I'll never forget that Israeli soldier who was nice to me. But it is kind of underpinning. I mean, I've lived here 20 years, and I haven't been so emotionally caught up till this incident. In fact, I even argued with a patient, which I've never done before. And it just
got it. So let's really let Professor Walzer address it. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. We haven't been talking about what's called in just war theory jus ad bellum, the justice of the war itself. We've been focused on jus in bello, the justice of the conduct of the war. But I strongly believe that these two are independent questions, that even in an unjust war, it's important to hold both armies, including the unjust army, to certain standards of conduct in the field. Let me try to say something about the issue of ad bellum, jus ad bellum. Now, I began my preparatory remarks today by saying that I thought this was a war that wouldn't have happened had there been Israeli policies of the sort of the sort that Shalom Achshav has been advocating for a long time. If the Palestinians on the West Bank were being liberated from the settler movement and saw themselves as being on the road to statehood and sovereignty, I don't think the Hamas's claim to be fighting against the occupation would have made any sense or would have been politically viable. So yes, this was a war that could have been prevented, and over a very long period of time. But there is a more immediate issue, and that is whether what's called the siege of Gaza justifies the tactics of Hamas. And whether, because if it doesn't, then the Israeli response to the rockets and the tunnels is a just response. It is self-defense, which is the paradigmatic version of a just war. So let's talk a bit about the siege of Gaza. First of all, it's not an Israeli siege. It's a joint Israeli-Egyptian siege. And it had, at least until this war, it had the tacit support of the PA, of the Palestine Authority, which means of Fatah, which probably hates Hamas more than it hates Israel. So it isn't a siege that Israel could have lifted by itself. In fact, the Egyptians could have ended the siege at any time just by opening the Rafah crossing. So... And also, you might say, looking at the tunnels and at the rocket, the manufacturer of rockets, that if the energy and the resources that are invested in the tunnels and the rocket manufacture had been invested in housing and schools, Gaza might not look like an area that was under siege. It would look very, very different. Looking at the tunnels and the rockets, you might say the siege was spectacularly unsuccessful because an awful lot of building material and other material somehow got in. So I am not inclined to think that the siege was an Israeli crime that justified the firing of rockets into Israel. That does not make sense to me. And the firing of rockets does justify. We all know this, that any state experiencing the kind of rocket fire that Israel has experienced would respond, and probably respond, if I imagine, say. Being rocketed from Wales by a passionate nationalist secessionist movement, I suspect their response, if all their cities were being rocketed, would be a lot crueler than the Israeli response, partly because people would care less about the deaths they were inflicting. So I think this is within its limits as a war between Hamas and Israel. This is, on Israel's part, a just war. It is a war of defense. But over the long haul, I think that Israel's policies have produced these periodic crises, which might have been avoided. Could have been avoided were there a policy of could have been avoided by a government committed to defeating the settler movement and moving toward a Palestinian statehood. That's what I believe. There are people who think that the religious zealotry now prevailing in the Islamic world makes that a pipe dream, but I cling to it with my friends in Shalom Achshav.
Very much, and I guess this is an appropriate message to end the call on. I want to apologize profusely to quite a few people who still raised their hands asking to ask questions, and I simply cannot accommodate them. I promised Professor Walzer that we won't keep him more than an hour, and we're there. We will have more briefing calls soon, both about this issue and other issues. And again, I want to thank you all for joining us. Before we leave, just a quick shout-out for our NewsNosh. NewsNosh is PN's daily review of the Israeli Hebrew media. If you haven't subscribed to it yet, this is the time to do it, because I know that everyone is seeking and interested in news from Israel. So please go to our website. You will fill a very short online form, and you then will receive NewsNosh, Israeli news, fresh to your inbox every morning. Professor Walder, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And
it was a good, those were tough, good questions.
Thank you. And thanks to all the participants, all of you who joined us. We'll see you soon in another APN briefing call. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.